Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso. As the Ukrainian crisis worsens, local Ukrainian Americans from San Diego and East County held a rally locally calling on the U.S. for help, and we'll bring you coverage on today's show. Santee's City Council has approved sale of land to build a hotel at a site formerly designated for a new library, and we'll have details on that. After revelations that San Francisco police used DNA from a rape kit to charge the victim with a crime, we asked San Diego County's sheriff and district attorney if that's being done here, and we'll share their responses on today's show. An effort to recall Poway Mayor Steve Voss has fallen short, and we'll have reaction from Mayor Voss today. Hear why East County's three supervisors split their votes on a county plan for complying with the state's new vehicle miles traveled requirements, which could make it costlier to build homes in some unincorporated areas. Valhalla High School's choir from El Cajon performed an impromptu concert aboard an airliner bound for Europe. Hear why on today's show. After decades of seeking a high school for Alpine, the community will finally have a charter high school opening, along with a new sports field, and we'll have details. Then on Green Scene, hear about plans for a new freshwater lake in Lakeside, where visitors will be able to swim with fish and cool off beneath a waterfall. Then learn about new subsidies approved by county supervisors to help keep low-income seniors from becoming homeless. Plus, we'll have details on a robbery at a church in Lemon Grove and the help needed to restock their food pantry to feed people in need. As the one-year anniversary of COVID-19 vaccines comes around, we've got a report from California News Service on the success of community clinics in meeting vaccine needs. A strong storm is moving into our region, bringing heavy rain, gusty winds, and snow that is forecast to impact Interstate 8 in East County with potential whiteout conditions. The California State University System's chancellor has resigned after revelations that he failed to take action over alleged sexual harassment by an employee. If you're a parent or a caregiver of an infant, you'll want to be sure to stay tuned for details today about a recall of several contaminated infant formulas tied to several hospitalizations and a death. Then on Crime Beat, hear about a bust of alleged lingerie thieves in an organized retail theft ring targeting Victoria's Secrets in our region. We'll also have some breaking national news from Public News Service, including Ukraine's president speaking out on the impending Russian invasion, Donald Trump's return to social media, and some troubling domestic violence statistics. And at the end of our show today, we'll take you on the road to the Water Conservation Garden at Cuyamaca College in one of our Best of East County episodes. We'll also be re-airing our interview with Timothy Daniels, the author of An Ongoing Investigation Set Along Our International Border. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. With Russian troops poised to invade the Ukraine, Ukrainians in San Diego held a rally in Balboa Park over the weekend urging America to help the Ukrainian people. Among the participants were residents of East County. Around 80 people attended the Stand with Ukraine rally. They sang the Ukrainian national anthem and other songs, many also waving American flags. Times of San Diego, East County Magazine's news partner, was at the rally and spoke with concerned Ukrainian Americans. Just 2 months after gaining his U.S. citizenship, Pastor Yuri Sats of Carmel Valley delivered a benediction in his native tongue. His Ukrainian Catholic Church congregation is building a church now in Santee. Holding a microphone, Andriy Fedunyak said, "As the world unites against the fury of a madman, I plead to my motherland, America, for help." He stressed that his group was not asking for the sacrifice of American lives on Ukrainian soil. He said, "We are asking for your help in arming ourselves against this threat. Give us the tools and training so we can have a fighting chance, because if Ukraine falls, it will be too late. Vodunyak said Russia would then be at NATO's doorstep, and American daughters and sons will once again spill blood on European land, he added. A man passing by sounded the lone dissenting voice as he shouted, "Let's start another war. Makes sense for our economy." But he was drowned out by the crowd. The San Diego rally was one of many held over the weekend, including one in Washington, D.C., organized under the leadership of the Ukrainian Freedom Foundation, in coordination with Ukrainian activists in L.A. and San Francisco. Their press release states, after 8 years of frozen conflict, 29 ceasefires, 15,000 lives lost, millions of refugees and orphans, Russia is amassing over 100,000 troops on the Ukrainian border and is ready to attack again. San Diego Ukrainian Americans are asking their fellow Americans for unwavering support for the Ukrainian people to prevent a potential world war. Free and sovereign Ukraine is also in American interest, the press release concludes. Alexander Dubovenko of La Mesa, a former Kiev resident who moved to America in 2000, played guitar as children sang, including a modern Ukrainian song. He said he spoke Russian originally, but has used only Ukrainian since Russia's 2014 annexation of Crimea. Dubovenko told Times of San Diego that nobody knows what Russian President Vladimir Putin will decide, but he fears he is capable of anything. He said his Ukrainian relatives have means of escaping. "But they're not going to escape," he said. "They're going to fight." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is John Tidwell with a local government report from Santee. Santee's latest action is a win for tourists, but a loss for students and other library aficionados. The city's grand plan to turn part of Trolley Square into an arts and entertainment district took a big step forward on February 9th, when the city council approved a land sale for construction of a four-story hotel. The site was once planned as a new library, but the council dropped that concept 2 years ago and decided that the property was better suited for a hotel aimed at regional tourists. So the city council unanimously approved the development agreement with XL Acquisitions LLC for the planned hotel. It will include 89 rooms, a swimming deck, and parking, with the city receiving $1.4 million. XL promises to bring in either Hilton or Marriott to run the hotel and hopes to finalize the deal by December 1st. Mayor John Minto told East County Magazine that the city needs more rooms to handle the increasing number of visitors to Santee, particularly families cheering on sons or daughters competing at tournaments hosted at the Sportsplex complex adjacent to Town Center Community Park. Mayor Minto says some of those tournaments last for several days and that many fans are currently staying outside the city. The city has been talking with XL for years, but was thwarted in getting the project going due to litigation with Santee Trolley Square's owner in a dispute over the parcel's ownership. The city and the center owner settled their legal dispute in early February, paving the way for the official agreement. A hotel would generate significant tax revenues for the city, but many Santee citizens who've heard the council talk about building a new library facility for decades feel as though the project is a very low priority. Cheryl Cosart, Santee Friends of the Library president, says while she understands city leaders' desire to improve the tax base, she hopes to continue working with them to get a new library built. The current library is in an aging strip mall off Carlton Hills Boulevard and has insufficient parking and ongoing plumbing problems. The tiny space, one of the smallest in San Diego County, means readers usually must order books through the county's online website and pick them up later. When the city council abandoned plans for a library site at Trolley Square 2 years ago, it never designated an alternate site. A tentative plan to combine a library with a community center was also abandoned about a year ago. Mayor Minto says the city has been talking to a number of landowners about finding the right site for a new library, but hasn't been successful. He adds, "We'd like it to be someplace in the arts and entertainment area, adding that the lack of a new library hasn't been for lack of trying. Two other key developments for the Arts District that the city hoped would be open by now are either dead or appear unlikely to happen. A theater restaurant called Studio Movie Grill went bankrupt last year, killing that project. Carl Strauss Brewery, approved by the city in 2015 as the new headquarters for the successful San Diego brewery, along with a tasting room and restaurant behind Trolley Square, has not been able to make any headway towards construction. The project had some early opposition from Preserve Wild Santee, a local environmental group, but those differences were settled in 2019, just before the pandemic hit. Mayor Minto said if nothing happens by the end of this year, Carl Strauss will lose its entitlement. But not all of Santee's plans have taken a hit. Another hotel, Woodspring Suites, a division of Choice Hotels, was approved by the council 2 years ago and is slated to be built at the intersection of State Routes 52 and 125.
After revelations that San Francisco police used DNA collected from rape kits to charge a rape victim with a property crime, San Francisco's district attorney dismissed the charges and called the police actions a violation of the Fourth Amendment, which prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures. So East County Magazine asked the San Diego Sheriff's Department whether it has submitted rape victims' DNA collected at hospitals to a database that could be used to link rape victims to other crimes. Within hours of our request, Lieutenant Amber Baggs, the Sheriff's Media Relations Director, sent this response. No, we do not do this. I read the article as well and checked with our crime lab director. We do not match victims' DNA to other crimes. A spokesperson for San Diego's district attorney has also assured that the DA has never received a request from any local law enforcement agency to prosecute a rape victim for another crime based on DNA obtained from a rape kit. In the San Francisco case, the DNA had been collected from a rape victim back in 2016, stored and used to recently charge her with a 2021 crime, the San Francisco Chronicle reported. Ironically, media has been unable to determine whether police ever caught or held the rapist accountable in the crime they were supposed to investigate. Rachel Marshall, a spokesperson for San Francisco's district attorney, has said that the DA there did not know that police used rape victims' DNA to solve other crimes until the office reviewed paperwork in the recent case. Marshall told National Public Radio, "This is illegal," adding that after learning that the procedure is routine for San Francisco's police department, the DA is working to end the practice. Marshall added, "It is our top priority to ensure that we are not dissuading survivors from coming forward or creating additional barriers to report rapes." San Francisco's DA is now working with State Senator Scott Wiener and local leaders to introduce legislation that would prohibit DNA evidence from a victim's rape kit from being used for anything other than investigating that crime. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Marie Johnson.
Poway Mayor Steve Voss won't face a recall election over alleged violations of political laws and claims of non-disclosures about his annual Carols by Candlelight charity concert. A recall petition drive came up short, with only 5,127 signatures, at least 6,541 verified signatures from Poway voters were required by the deadline, February 18th. Chris Olps, leader of the recall drive, had announced plans to run for mayor if the recall had succeeded, but now says he won't turn in the signatures gathered to avoid potential harassment, Times of San Diego reports. Mayor Voss gained countywide name recognition after the Shabbat synagogue shooting in Poway and through his campaign to represent District 2, including much of East County, on the County Board of Supervisors, a race that was won by Joel Anderson. On Friday, Mayor Voss told Times of San Diego via email, "The failure of the recall comes as no surprise, given that it was a politically motivated stunt by a five-time losing city council candidate. As mayor, I focus on the issues that matter to residents. That's what I've always done and will continue to do. Olps has also accused Voss of letting developers line his campaign pockets. But Voss says the recall campaign was based on lies, noting that a special election could also have cost taxpayers nearly $1 million if the failed recall petition drive had succeeded. This is John Tidwell reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ.
The state's new Vehicle Miles Traveled Law, or VMT, seeks to reduce greenhouse gases by requiring fees from developers for projects that result in vehicles traveling farther than the regional average. Projects where drivers travel 15% fewer miles than the regional average, such as infill developments near roads, jobs, and transit, can be built without costly studies and mitigation soon to be required of other projects. Local jurisdictions are mandated to comply with the state law, but have some flexibility. So by a 3-2 vote, San Diego County supervisors recently voted to try and balance local housing needs with the state's goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions in a two-phase approach. The first phase is short-term, to firm up within 6 months the definition of infill areas in unincorporated communities where housing developments could be built without triggering VMT study and mitigation requirements. Phase two is a long-range plan. Staff must return to the board in 4 months with a sustainable land use framework that could lead to an update of the county general plan to unlock vast parts of the unincorporated areas where development may be stymied by the state's VMT requirements. Supervisors' action applies only to the county's unincorporated areas, not to local cities. The three supervisors who now have substantial unincorporated areas in their districts split their votes, with Chair Nathan Fletcher in favor, but Supervisors Joel Anderson and Jim Desmond opposed. Fletcher noted that adopting a vehicle miles traveled, or VMT, policy is mandatory under state law, but he said, "The opportunity in front of us is to accept that we have to tackle climate change and we have to build housing, and look for the most legally viable way in which we can put the housing in the right places, meet our climate goals, and build more housing than we have ever built before." According to Fletcher, the plan greenlights and exempts over 4,000 housing units from VMT costs, and also allows affordable housing to be built without VMT costs anywhere in the unincorporated areas. Fletcher predicts the plan will drive unprecedented residential development in areas poised for near-term growth, while putting the county on a path to establish a long-term VMT mitigation strategy to ensure continued housing development in unincorporated areas. While Supervisor Anderson agrees with the goal of making it easier to build homes, during the board discussion, he called the county's estimates of homes the plan would allow disingenuous. He cited two properties in Spring Valley, one a vacant lot, the other with a house on it that would have to be destroyed to build up to 15 units. But there's no incentive for a property owner to do so, Anderson said. He asked how many lots in the proposal already have homes on them, but staff had no answer. Anderson said the plan isn't real, then opined that it was easier 60 years ago going to the moon than building homes in San Diego today. Anderson ran on a platform of making it easier to build homes and prevent the next generation from having to move outside the region. He said, "Everyone on this board wants a path forward so we can have generational wealth for minorities, but that this won't happen by talking and never building." When the vote was called, Anderson responded, "Sadly, no." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Elijah McKee.
That's the sound of the Valhalla Vocal Music Choir from El Cajon performing an impromptu concert aboard a British Airways flight earlier this month after the plane was delayed. Students at Valhalla High School are known as the Norsemen, and the choir was on the way to Scandinavia via London when their flight out of San Diego was delayed due to technical problems. The choir members chose the song Shosholosa, sung in South Africa by tribes working in gold mines. The choir decided to start singing to keep the spirits of the other passengers up, according to Adam Gray, who posted the video on Instagram. The incident was later reported by the Glasgow Live News site and has since gone viral on social media. Gray, a Scottish passenger, was on board along with his wife when the unexpected entertainment occurred, drawing applause from stranded passengers. Valhalla's vocal music department was established in 1974 and includes 5 different choirs. Vocal music students perform in at least 4 concerts each year, as well as participating in field trips and travel opportunities. The group even managed to record a concert virtually during the pandemic, which you can watch at valhallavocalmusic.com/. This is Marie Johnson reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
This is Miriam Raftery with an education report. For over 20 years, Alpine residents have pined for a high school, even engaging in unsuccessful litigation with the Grossmont Union High School District after it reneged on promises to build one due to declining district enrollment. So local parents and educators began searching for alternatives. And in August, Liberty Charter High School will open in Alpine at the site of the recently closed Alpine Elementary School. Until now, Alpine students in grades 9 through 12 have had to commute long distances to attend public high schools in Lakeside, El Cajon, or Spring Valley, a sometimes perilous journey in icy winter weather. Dr. Rich Newman, superintendent of the Alpine Union School District, made the announcement in a letter to families. Newman said a high school has long been a top goal for the board, adding, "There's been a tremendous amount of work behind the scenes over the years to make an Alpine high school a reality." He added that he's over the moon to announce that his district's Board of Trustees plans to approve leasing the Alpine Elementary School site to Liberty Charter High. Renovations will start immediately to turn the facility into a state-of-the-art high school learning center, the superintendent adds. The high school will operate separately from Alpine Union School District and from Grossmont. It will be overseen by the County Office of Education instead, under the leadership of Debbie Beyer, the executive director of Liberty Charter. Newman says Alpine students will have priority to enroll in the new school, adding that Liberty Charter is actually one of the oldest and highest performing charter high schools in San Diego. The curriculum will include AP, honors, and college prep courses, career exploration, and dual credit classes. Students will even have national and international travel opportunities, community service, competitive sports teams, including CIF championships, and clubs. Along with developing critical thinking and STEM skills, students also learn skills such as leadership, teamwork, public speaking, and more. On average, each Liberty High School senior class receives almost $4 million in scholarship awards, including merit-based and athletic. Newman says he looks forward to seeing a high school finally join the Alpine community, and he signed his letter to parents, "Proudest superintendent and principal on earth." George Barnett, the treasurer and past president of the Alpine Education Association, also voiced enthusiasm. He told East County Magazine, "Our long-awaited high school has become a reality." The Grossmont Union High School District's decision to halt plans to build an Alpine high school several years ago, after acquiring land for its construction, embittered many in Alpine. Parents and other taxpayers contended they had twice voted for Grossmont bond measures that promised to fund the school. And the San Diego County Grand Jury agreed, issuing a blistering report titled, "Fool Me Once, Fool Me Twice." The grand jury advised that Grossmont should either build the high school or turn over money to the Alpine Union School District so that it could expand beyond elementary and middle schools to build a public high school. But Grossmont did neither, and a lawsuit by angry Alpiners proved unsuccessful. The last action of the now-defunct Alpine High School Citizens Committee was to seek legal counsel review of charter options. Their research identified Liberty Charter as one of the best options for Alpine Union to consider. While the new charter high school comes as welcome news for many Alpine residents, it will likely mean a substantial loss of average daily attendance money for the Grossmont District at a time when district finances are already impacted by 2 years of pandemic shutdowns and other COVID-related costs. Now, it's unclear whether the Grossmont District will be able to continue to operate all of its existing high schools if many Alpine students opt to leave the Grossmont District and attend Liberty Charter High. The new Liberty Charter High, slated to open in August, isn't the only new addition for Alpine students. Construction is also underway at Joan McQueen Middle School on a new regulation-sized football and soccer field with artificial turf. Alpine's youth sports organizations and schools will soon be able to hold sports events at the new Field of Dreams that, like the high school, is finally becoming a reality.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is John Tidwell with a Green Scene Report. Imagine swimming beneath waterfalls alongside fish in a freshwater lake. That dream is all part of the ambitious plans that Lakeside River Park Conservancy has announced for a new park at Channel Road in Lakeside. Work began on the park in 2004 with the creation of a new entrance near Channel Road. The process was slowed by the recession, but now the organization is fundraising to move forward. In a newsletter to members, the Lakeside River Park Conservancy states, "We are planning a huge freshwater swimming lake. We always knew we would build a community pool because Lakeside is hot and our community needs one. This lake will take community pools to the next level with waterfalls and fish, adding, get your snorkel out. Plans also include a 5-acre children's play area with spaces for different age levels, each with its own water feature. To protect children's safety, the play area will be fenced and gated, with children only allowed to leave with their parents. In the past 20 years, the Conservancy has completed a 100-acre restoration of the San Diego River in Lakeside, including 2 miles of trails, with native vegetation providing shade to make trails usable year-round. The Conservancy also recently completed an 80-acre restoration in El Monte Valley and built a mile-long trail there. For more information, you can visit lakesideriverpark.org.
By a unanimous vote, San Diego County Supervisors recently approved asking staff to come up with a pilot program to provide modest subsidies for low-income older adults at risk of homelessness who are struggling to pay their rent. The proposal was introduced by Supervisors Joel Anderson and Tara Lawson Reamer. The proposed pilot program is a direct outcome of findings in the Serving Seniors Homelessness Needs Assessment Report back in September, which found that many older adults become homeless because they lack an economic safety net. They suffer catastrophic events with dire financial consequences. Of the 400 low-income and homeless older adults surveyed for the study, more than half, 56%, said that an additional $300 or less of monthly income would increase their rent security. Estimates provided by county staff for current emergency shelter operating costs, including services, range between $2,500 and $6,000 per individual per month. Staff will bring back details of the pilot program to supervisors within 90 days. Paul Downey is CEO of Serving Seniors, a nonprofit that helps low-income seniors. He says, "This shallow subsidy is a strategic investment in preventing homelessness in the first place. This is a model colleagues across the country are eager to implement." In his presentation, Supervisor Anderson said, "Instead of waiting for our seniors to become homeless to help them, we are being proactive." Anderson said the program will lead to a better life outcome for seniors in need, as well as cost savings for taxpayers. He added, "These subsidies pale in comparison to the cost of having people on the streets and gives us the opportunity to lift them up." Supervisor Lawson Reamer said, "No seniors should be sleeping on a sidewalk because they've lost their home," adding that the program is data-driven and shows that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. "If the pilot program is effective, it could be a game-changer," she added. 141 members of the community provided written comments in favor of the proposal. There were also speakers in favor representing various organizations, including the Regional Task Force on Homelessness, St. Paul's PACE, Jewish Family Services, and more. Older adults are the fastest-growing segment of the unsheltered population. According to San Diego's 2020 point-in-time count, 1 in 4 of San Diego's homeless adults is over age 55. There are 2,000 older homeless adults here, and that number is projected to triple over the next decade. San Diego's regional housing supply has not kept pace with the needs of low-income older adults, where wait lists for subsidies and voucher programs can extend several years. There are currently 68,000 individuals on the San Diego County Housing Choice Voucher waitlist and nearly 40,000 individuals on waitlists for project-based vouchers. The supervisors who authored the proposal suggested that the county utilize funds already appropriated through the federal American Rescue Plan to fund the pilot program. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Marie Johnson.
Thieves broke into the food pantry at St. John's of the Cross Church on Broadway in Lemon Grove on February 8th. stealing and damaging food items used to feed people in need. Councilmember Jennifer Mendoza says the food pantry at the church is staffed on Wednesdays and Thursdays from 9 a.m. till noon. She adds, any donations are much appreciated. The Lemon Grove Improvement Council can help pick up items if needed, or someone can drop them off at Lee's Automotive. Food items needed include non-perishable products, such as canned or dry beans, dried fruits, peanut or other nut butters, canned vegetables or fruits especially low sodium, unsalted nuts and seeds, canned tuna or chicken, whole grain pastas and sauces, canned soups or stews, brown rice, oats, and shelf-stable milk products. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Elijah McKee.
Community health centers have led the charge against COVID-19, administering more than 19 million shots over the past year. Death and infection rates are lower in areas served by a community health center, according to a study from Morehouse University and the National Association of Community Health Centers. Dr. Ann Gagliotti with Morehouse says the numbers are particularly impressive because 44% of centers report being short-staffed.
I know that they are tired and they've experienced a huge amount of loss. And despite that, they're still coming to work every day and caring for folks, caring for their neighbors.
More than 900,000 Americans have died of COVID-19, including more than 82,000 in California. The state's COVID dashboard shows that almost 71 million vaccines have been administered in the Golden State so far, with more than 82% of the population, age 5 and older, receiving at least one shot. Dr. Mike Witte is chief medical officer at the California Primary Care Association, which represents 180 organizations that run more than 1,300 community health centers in the state. He says health center staff are working to reduce vaccine hesitancy.
Community health centers are positioned to help develop trust and then use of the vaccine by virtue of the fact that they are staffed by people from the community who are culturally and linguistically accessible to all patients.
A recent study in the Journal of the American Medical Association found that federally qualified health centers are improving vaccine equity, administering more than 60% of their shots to people of color. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso.
A severe winter storm is moving into our area, forecast to bring heavy rains across most of the county, along with high winds and substantial snow in mountain areas Monday through Wednesday this week. Snowfall is forecast to dip below 4,000 feet, including portions of Interstate 8 east of Alpine, Julian, and other regions. Mount Laguna could get up to a foot and a half of snow, with 6 to 8 inches forecast for Julian. The blizzard could create whiteout conditions in snowy areas, so avoid travel if possible. Frost is forecast for some valley areas, including Ramona and Escondido. Gusts of up to 70 miles an hour are forecast in the mountains and in desert areas such as Borrego and Ocotillo Wells. Along the coast, strong rip currents will result in dangerous swimming conditions, while rough seas and gusty winds will cause hazardous conditions for small boats through Wednesday. Thunderstorms are also possible, potentially bringing hail and up to an inch and a half of rain in some parts of the county. So folks, if you have to be out in this weather, please drive carefully, watch for downed power lines and limbs, and stay safe.
California State University Chancellor Joseph Castro has resigned from his post, effective immediately, over accusations that he mishandled sexual assault and workplace intimidation claims against a former colleague while president of Fresno State University. Castro had just completed his first year as the first Mexican-American chancellor of the nation's largest four-year public university system. He submitted his resignation to the Cal State Board of Trustees on February 18th, Cal Matters reports. CSU's governing body met behind closed doors the entire day, debating his fate. In a written statement, Castro said, "The decision to resign is the most difficult of my professional life. While I disagree with many aspects of recent media reports and the ensuing commentary, it has become clear to me that resigning at this time is necessary so that the CSU can maintain its focus squarely on its educational mission and the impactful work yet to be done." The fallout stems from a February bombshell exposé by USA Today, reporting that Castro was personally aware of at least 7 complaints against Frank Lamas, the head of campus student affairs at Fresno State. The complaints against Lamas detailed a pattern of alleged sexual harassment of women, inappropriate touching, intimidation, and retaliation against workers, USA Today reported. Those complaints spanned the 6 years he was on the job. Despite knowledge of the allegations, Castro still recommended Lamas for an achievement award and later, rather than firing or calling for his resignation, paid him $260,000 and full retirement benefits to leave his post. The settlement forbade Lamas from ever working again at the Cal State system, but promised him a letter of recommendation if he wanted to work at a different college. 3 weeks after the settlement, the Cal State Board of Trustees formally hired Castro as the next chancellor, overseeing 23 CSU system campuses starting in January 2021. USA Today also reported that Castro said he conferred with then-Chancellor Timothy White on how to proceed with Lamas. The report said both Castro and White agreed paying Lamas off was easier than enduring a potentially expensive legal fight with him. Lamas told USA Today that he denied all allegations of wrongdoing. At least two Cal State campus presidents have said Castro should have acted much sooner. Adele De La Torre, president of San Diego State University, confirmed that gender-based harassment must be immediately reported to the Title IX officer. She called Castro's decision to step down the right choice. Castro's resignation follows student protests on multiple campuses, as well as calls for him to resign from some lawmakers and faculty members. Executive Vice Chancellor and Chief Financial Officer Steve Relier will take over as acting chancellor until an interim chancellor has been named. Cal State policy indicates that Castro is entitled to about $400,000 in compensation for the next year, and although he resigned as chancellor, he is entitled to a full professor position at the Cal State system, CalMatters reports. At the upcoming March meeting, the Board of Trustees plans to vote to bring on an outside group that will conduct a system-wide assessment to improve CSU's Title IX and civil rights training. But the CSU faculty union says review is insufficient. In a statement issued after Castro's resignation, the faculty union states, "Only a public, open, and independent investigation by the state legislature can produce impartial results, which can lead to the systemic changes we need to see." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Elijah McKee.
This is Miriam Raftery with a health alert for parents and caregivers of babies. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, is warning not to use recalled powdered infant formulas marketed under the brand names Similac, Alimentum, and Elicare. These products were sold throughout the U.S. and in other countries. The recall was triggered by 4 cases of Cronobacter sekaizaki infections and 1 report of Salmonella infection in infants. All 4 infants tied to these cases were hospitalized, and the tainted formula is believed to have contributed to at least 1 baby's death. All of the recalled formulas were produced at Abbott Nutrition's Michigan facility. An inspector found Cronobacter in adverse conditions at the site. The recall includes only powdered formulas, not liquids. The recalled products all have expiration dates of April 1, 2022 or later. You can find product codes included in the recall at FDA.gov. Cronobacter bacteria could cause severe life-threatening infections, including sepsis and meningitis. Symptoms may include poor feeding, irritability, temperature changes, jaundiced or yellow skin and eyes, grunting breaths, and abnormal movements. Cronobacter infection may also cause bowel damage and can spread through the blood to other parts of the body. If your child is experiencing any of these symptoms, you should notify your child's doctor and seek medical care immediately.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
On Valentine's Day, the California Highway Patrol's organized retail theft team busted 3 suspects caught with thousands of dollars worth of bras, panties, and other lingerie items stolen from Victoria's Secret stores across San Diego County. An investigator from L Brands, which serves Victoria's Secret and Pink, among other stores, identified an organized theft crew that repeatedly victimized these stores along the West Coast. Juan Escobar with the CHP says, "The organized crime ring is suspected of committing the theft of hundreds of thousands of dollars in merchandise throughout several states." According to the CHP, the suspects rented a car in the Bay Area, then headed as far south as National City for the sole purpose of committing retail thefts. The suspects were observed at malls in Mission Valley, Plaza Bonita, UTC, and Carlsbad, all within a few hours. they were observed committing thefts at two Victoria's Secret stores locally, where they stole 329 items worth over $16,000. A countywide Be on the Lookout was issued. Soon after, officers from the Carlsbad Police Department found the suspect vehicle near a mall in Carlsbad. An enforcement stop was made on I-5, and the suspects were arrested. All the stolen merchandise was located in the vehicle. The suspects were transported to the Escondido Police Department, which has opened investigations with the same theft ring due to previous thefts in their jurisdiction. The suspects ranged in age from 18 to 21. All were from Northern California. They have been booked into San Diego County jails for violations, including organized retail crime. A multi-agency investigation continues, seeking to learn the full magnitude of this retail crime ring. The California Highway Patrol has dedicated organized retail theft teams that work with retailers and allied agencies to combat sophisticated groups that have been victimizing merchants throughout the state. Anyone with information regarding organized retail thefts can report it to the CHP online at chp.ca.gov. Click the Notify tab at the top, then choose the Organized Retail Theft option to file a report. This is John Tidwell with a Crime Beat report from East County Magazine on KNSJ.
And next up, we have some breaking national news for you from Public News Service.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
There is no such thing as "it is not my war" in the 21st century. That annexation of the Crimea and the war in the Donbass is a blow to the whole world.
Vladimir Zelensky at the Munich Security Conference. As fears increase over a potential Russian invasion, the Ukrainian president proposed meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Reports from U.S. intelligence agencies are contradicting Russian de-escalation claims and say Moscow is moving towards war. Russia and Belarus have said they are extending military drills. The reason the Kremlin has given for the 150,000 troops now near Ukraine. Fighting is also flaring in the eastern parts of the country, led by pro-Russian separatists. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, alongside other Democratic representatives in Munich, said diplomacy is not off the table. But if Russia attacks, she holds Putin personally responsible.
The U.S. is here, fully committed in a unified way to work with our European allies in the interest of diplomacy.
The U.S. Embassy in Moscow on Sunday issued a security warning on possible threats to Americans in Moscow and St. Petersburg. Officials there are encouraging Americans to avoid crowds and have evacuation plans ready that do not rely on U.S. government help. Former President Donald Trump's new social media network, Truth Social, is expected to debut today in the Apple App Store. The network's launch would mark Trump's return to social media after he was permanently banned from Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube following the January 6th Capitol attack. Nationwide, the U.S. is now averaging about 140,000 new COVID cases a day. That's down nearly two-thirds over 2 weeks. The virus still kills about 16,000 Americans each week, but CDC Director Rochelle Walensky says they're lowering the level of some travel warnings.
The science is evolving, the science is moving, and we are following the science each and every day, and our guidance is evolving as the science evolves.
More than one in four women have experienced domestic violence before they reach 50. That's according to a new study published by The Lancet, which compiled physical and sexual violence data from 2000 to 2018. Futures Without Violence director Kirsten Stewart offers advice for those worried about someone they know.
Ideally, you can find a quiet time to talk to the person you're concerned about and really just ask them. We encourage people not to blame somebody, not to shame, to just make themselves available to have a conversation.
For confidential 24/7 help, call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-7233. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
We're on the road in East County. visiting some amazing towns and meeting some incredible people across our region. Welcome to another adventure on East County Magazine's On the Road.
A fun place to visit in El Cajon is the Water Conservation Garden. Located on the Cuyamaca College campus, this garden is fully surrounded with flowers, plants, ponds, wildlife, and educational interactives. It's a place for both children and adults to enjoy and learn about water-wise gardening, fire-resistant landscaping, native plants, and vegetable gardens.
The garden is a flurry of activities. We have workshops here of every kind, about your landscape, about making cheese, crafting classes.
Not only is this park a great place to visit, but it has an important mission behind its purpose. Director of Operations and Programs Pam Meisner emphasized the focus of the garden is to educate on eco-friendly and efficient gardening. Miss Smarty Plants is one of the workshop programs she runs for kids.
I think the best part about being Miss Smarty Plants is that I get to see the innocence, the wonder of a child every day. I truly believe in my heart of hearts, our youth is going to save the earth.
The garden offers field trips for kids, yoga classes, and other events depending on the season, but is also a pleasant and relaxing place to walk amid a beautiful environment.
Once you know it's here and once you come here, you don't have to sell the garden. It sells itself.
Because this is a nonprofit organization, the garden's finances took a hit, causing it to require a submission fee for entry as opposed to being free.
We used to be a totally free garden. We used to be totally free. We changed to an admissions model when we were able to open back up.
The Water Conservation Garden is open Tuesday to Sunday, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m., and open until 6 p.m. on Thursdays. For more information about the exciting and enjoyable things the Water Conservation Garden has to offer, visit the website at thegarden.org.
Miss Smarty Plant's mantra is, we can change the world with our own two hands.
And for East County Magazine, I'm Angela Kurish.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the mountains to the sea.
And next up, we're going to play one of our Best of East County episodes, re-airing our interview with Timothy Daniels, author of An Ongoing Investigation.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm speaking with Timothy Daniels, retired supervisory special agent of U.S. Customs, or ICE, and author of the new novel, An Ongoing Investigation. My guest, who has a long history of working with narcotic smuggling cases and money laundering, he brings a unique perspective to a border city like San Diego. An Ongoing Investigation is the sequel to his debut novel, A Target-Rich Environment, which was published in 2011. Welcome, Tim. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
And thank you for having me, Raina.
Let's begin with An Ongoing Investigation. I know the story is about a task force trying to stem the flow of narcotics coming into the U.S. from Mexico. Tell us a little bit more about what happens in the book.
Well, first, I would just like to say that I don't think most people that live in this area have any kind of clear understanding of how much narcotics come across the border just on a constant basis.
Right.
And it's thousands of pounds probably a day.
Really?
So as I neared the end of my career, I decided that I would like to try to write a book and, you know, kind of paint a picture of what it was like to work in the war on drugs, which unfortunately we're losing. But, you know, there's just a lot of stories that I accumulated over the course of my career, and I wanted people to understand, number one, the amount of drugs coming across, and then what it was like to be involved in the war on drugs, and, you know, tell some of those stories, explain how difficult it is on family life, and, you know, what it requires of somebody. So in my two books, I basically took a fictitious character, Jimmy Maxwell, and I put him in a fictional case that runs 4 or 5 months. But during the middle of that case, it's interspersed with a lot of little sub-stories of cases that I worked on, you know, where I changed some of the names and details to cover that up. But for the most part, the little sub-stories are true. The overarching story, not so much.
So you got a chance to both tell the small stories of what really goes on and give a message about this is what's happening in San Diego.
Yes. And in the first novel, I went into some of the politics involved, which were very frustrating to most of us that were involved in this kind of work. Not so much in an ongoing investigation. I basically made that more focused on Jimmy and his personal relationships and, you know, what it was like to be the target of somebody who was out there trying to get him.
Now, for how many years did you do this work?
About 23.
A wealth of experience.
Yes.
And you're retired now.
I retired at the end of 2009.
Okay. So your protagonist, Jimmy Maxwell, is he you or is he a combination of several people, fully made up?
He's partially me. I mean, I would like to say that I had his work ethic, and I certainly was as busy as he is in the book during the course of my career. I went through some of those same personal struggles that he goes through. But on the other hand, several of my agents that I used to work with have told me that I'm actually more Tom, his supervisor, the grumpy old guy who, you know, is having to approve everybody's reports and, you know, be that buffer between upper management and the guys working on the street. So, yeah, anyway, a little me. I will say that, Jimmy, my main character, is a bourbon drinker, and I'm right there with him.
And you're a bourbon drinker, okay. I know you worked for Operation Alliance, which was the San Diego division of the DEA, and in marine smuggling investigations. And it sounds terrible and exciting and important. Do you miss the excitement? Do you relive your work when you're writing, or...
There's some of that. Operation Alliance is I spent 16 years of my almost 23 there, and that's mostly customs agents or now ICE agents, and then there's three or four DEA groups, and then there's a half a dozen local cops and a couple of other. I think we had an ATF agent and we had a couple of Border Patrol guys, you know, and it was family. It was like family to me to a large degree.
Could you explain Operation Alliance?
It was a task force of a bunch of different agencies that was formed to work smuggling cases in San Diego, so narcotic smuggling cases. And they respond both to the ports of entry, to seizures made by Customs and Border Protection, the uniformed guys. Also, they did proactive work. Some of it stemmed from follow-ups to port cases. Some was just developed through informants. Some was tips through other law enforcement contacts, San Diego Police Department's narcotics teams. So we worked kind of a wide variety of drug cases.
And you were a team, so when you work on the book, you're sort of making that team continue, would you say? Is that it?
Well, I'm trying to let the readers know what it was like to be part of the team.
A window.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk about what you said about the influence of family, how difficult it is on family. In your books, the love interest, Margie Gray, she worries about Jimmy Maxwell's safety and about other things. Now, with the safety of law enforcement in the news so much lately, is there anything you'd like to say about that? Was safety a big stressor on you and your family the way it is for your protagonist?
Not nearly as much, probably, as is portrayed in the book. Certainly, you know, we had our moments. I've been involved in search warrants where there were shootings and different things like that, and I was actually moved out of town for a couple of months with a handful of other agents after some threats came in against us. But for the most part, I didn't really spend a whole lot of time even thinking about that. The tougher part of the work is just being on call all the time. And,
right.
And sometimes you head out in the morning and you think you're coming home at 5, but you may not come home for several days.
Really?
You know, because you just don't know where the case is going to take you. But as for safety, local police have a far riskier job than we did as federal agents.
I see.
Because they're dealing with people that they really don't know. They respond to a radio call or pull somebody over for a traffic ticket, and you don't know if it's some guy on the 10 most wanted list or somebody that just hacked his wife up. Whereas normally we knew who we were targeting, so we took the appropriate amount of people with us to deal with that.
Could you tell us briefly one of the little stories in your book? Could you share with the listeners?
Well, one of the funny little stories involved an older lady who was in her late 70s, a white lady, and she came across the border one Friday night, and there was about 28 or 29 pounds of marijuana in the trunk of her car. And so I was interviewing her, and she just said, look, I went down with some friends of mine who live out here in El Cajon, and I had dinner, and I was getting tired, and they just said, take my car and go home. So I gave her a notice to appear. I tended to believe her. She told me who they were and the registration on the car matched. So on Monday morning, I took another agent friend and a El Cajon police detective, and we went and knocked on the door of this couple. The man who opened the door was wearing a pair of leopard skin bikini briefs. His legs were about 3 inches in diameter, you know, and he had a little belly and almost bald, had probably 3 chest hairs. And then he invites us in, and, you know, we tell him why we're there, and his wife comes out, and she sits in front of us and does the Sharon Stone leg cross thing. So I decide that, you know, I would like to take a look around the house because he's denying everything. Well, as we are looking around the house, there's a lot of adult-themed things, toys and gadgets. At one point, I went over to a closet and opened the door, and for about a half a second, I see this body falling out on me, and I actually pulled my gun. It startled me for, you know, it was dark, but it turned out it was a blow-up doll.
Oh,
and
goodness.
So, of course, my partners were all teasing me that, you know, if I would have shot it, it would have went zipping around the room like a, you know, balloon that got popped or something.
Okay. So you never know if something's going to be dangerous, serious, or a little bit light.
Or a little humorous.
Yeah, a little humorous. One last question, Tim. Tell us what's next in your sequel. I understand that you're writing sequel. When should we expect to see that?
Well, I haven't really decided whether or not I'm going to do another one. I'm leaning heavily towards it. An ongoing investigation kind of ends just before 9/11, so I'm thinking of trying to write a story that will incorporate a little bit of that into it. But I haven't worked out all the details yet. Both of these other books that I've written took about a year each. If I can get started in the next couple of months, you know, obviously it would be about a year from now before it would come out.
Well, we look forward to seeing it.
Well, I look forward to doing something productive with in my retired years here. So.
And Tim, our time is up, but thank you again for joining us.
Thank you.
For more information on Timothy Daniels and his work, please visit his publisher's website at sbpra.com/Timothy Daniels. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Priebel, Corey Clement, royalty-free music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.